Welcome to The Reading Room, the Diagnostic Imaging Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Whitney Palmer. When it comes to brain imaging, functional MRI, commonly called fMRI, is considered the gold standard. However, it can be costly, time-consuming, and come with several restrictions that can prohibit use with certain patients. In recent years, investigators have been searching for a different brain imaging method that can sidestep these problems and potentially provide better quality scans at the same time. Researchers from the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine and California Institute of Technology recently succeeded. They've developed functional photoacoustic computed tomography, FPACT, a technique that works by emitting a laser beam of light into the area being imaged. Today, Drs. Charles Liu and Jonathan Russin join me to discuss the differences and benefits with FPACT.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to join me today. Basically, to jump right in, you know, even with fMRI, you know, why has it been so important to look at new ways to image the human brain? And Dr. Russin, or if you want to begin.
Sure, yeah, I can start with this one. I think it's, you know, the environment of MRI. I mean, MRI has offered so much as far as structural imaging and advancing our ability to perform neurosurgical procedures safely. But it is performed in a magnetic field, and that has limitations. And with the in order to increase sort of the images that you can obtain with MRI, you need an ever-increasing magnetic field, right? The strength of the magnetic field, and that's that number in front of the T when you talk about magnets, like a 1.5T or a 3T, and now a 7T. And so this requires more infrastructure to house these, and they become more and more expensive, and they can have biologic side effects to put your head inside of a magnet that's that strong. So when you talk about functional human brain imaging, that's really what's become the gold standard is fMRI. And so to have an alternative that has potentially a more favorable environment to be in, also has in its infancy the ability to obtain images that are just as good and potentially do it faster and at a better resolution, I think that, you know, sort of potential is really important to develop, not to compete necessarily, but to complement functional MRI. And I'm interested if Charles has anything to add.
Yeah, I think that John is right. You know, I agree with everything that John has said, Dr. Russin has said. I would just say that, without a doubt, MRI technology and fMRI has been, you know, one of the most important tools that humans have developed to study brain function. If you look at how much we know about the brain since MRI and fMRI has become a useful tool for us, it's really, very, very impressive. Dr. Russin and I are neurosurgeons, and so, you know, we'd like to know what the structure is that we're operating on and also what the function is. But I think historically, there's never been a tool that's ever been invented that has no limitations. And so, you know, in the natural progress of the human endeavor, we seek to, you're never happy, right? So when something is really good, you then start focusing on the things that aren't good. So when we point out what we see as limitations, it's in no way a criticism of, you know, fMRI and MRI. It's really, in some ways, it's sort of being spoiled by what you can do already and wanting more. And the MRI environment is a, it is an adverse one, as you know. I mean, you know, anybody who goes in there goes through a screening list of things that you can't have, like implants, devices that your body is, that you have for treating lots of diseases. They really don't belong in that environment. And, very interestingly, many of the treatments for brain diseases now involve these devices. You know, we use them for epilepsy treatment. We use them for movement disorders. We use them for, you know, now they're being applied for cognitive issues, psychiatric, interventional psychiatry approaches. And, you know, to see what the brain function is, you know, after the device has been placed is, you know, not something that's really possible with fMRI and these types of devices. And so, you know, being, you know, focusing again on those things that the wonderful technologies that, you know, that are used now, focusing on those things that you can't do is really what has led to us to imagine what else it could be. And I think it's just a very natural way of things progress.
So then building on that, then what led you to want to start to develop or even test, you know, functional photoacoustic computed tomography, you know, this FPACT? What kind of got you to where you are now?
Well, I did my fellowship in cerebral vascular, and so I started a practice in bypass, and a lot of that has to do with altering kind of perfusion within the human brain. And so in order to image that, there's multiple different ways we do that. Some are perfusion imaging, and some of it is functional imaging, which is coupled, right? You're actually insinuating the function because of the change in blood flow. So, you know, it's been an interest of mine, and advanced imaging has been an interest of mine. And we have a great group here that really pushes the limits, the Lonnie group at USC. And Danny Wang has been a partner of ours for years. And Danny is just pushing the frontier of MRI imaging. And so, you know, photoacoustics was something that I explored sort of as a hobby. As a resident, and then when I became junior faculty, Danny has a close relationship with Lihong Wang at Caltech, and it was sort of one of those really fortunate conversations that me and Danny had. And I said, I fantasize about finding some way to use functional, you know, or photoacoustics to look at, you know, human brain perfusion. And Danny said, "That's funny. I got a guy you need to talk to." And I sat down and talked to Lihong, and I said, "We need to get Charles here because, you know, he's been up at Caltech and, you know, been working on sort of brain machine interface and advanced sort of imaging technologies." And I thought, you know, it would be a nice team to get together. And when everyone sat down, you know, we came up with a project that resulted in this this publication.
Yeah, I think this, you know, curiosity and necessity, right? The parents of invention, I suppose. And, you know, I think that, you know, John and I are both members of the USC Neuro Restoration Center. And, you know, the USC Neuro Restoration Center was sort of established to try to develop ways of, you know, achieving, I mean, a very, of course, aspirational goal, right, of functional restoration of the nervous system in all of its components, from cognitive to sensory motor to autonomically controlled. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, so much of that now is in the realm of devices and neuromodulation and brain computer interfaces and, you know, neuroprosthetics and things like that, that you know, the need from our end to know how these devices are affecting the function of the brain became very clear, you know, as, you know, we've been involved in the development of lots of these devices for clinical use, like vagus nerve stimulation and responsive neurostimulation with NeuroPace and different types of, you know, when we put these chips in the brain, right, for lack of a better term, then instantaneously these patients can no longer get an MRI, right? So the you're really quickly running up to the limits. And, you know, John is, as he mentioned, very interested in the role of blood flow perfusion as a restorative strategy. I mean, what is more restorative than good perfusion, right? And then, of course, the metaphorical information that comes from, you know, neurovascular coupling, right, as a metaphor for, you know, electrophysiology and other ways of understanding brain function. So you see this collision of need and interest. And as John mentioned, you know, really it became clear that a new technique and a new tool, right, needed to be developed. But as we all know, you know, new tools have to be compared against gold standards, right? How do you know that your new tool even works, you know, unless you can validate it against something else, right? And so, you know, this team that that came together that involves the fMRI expert, which is Danny Wang, that, you know, of the blood flow, you know, clinical person, Dr. Rustin, and the sort of the functional, you know, neurosurgeon person, you know, and myself, and Li Hong Wang, Dr. Wang, who, you know, has been working for years as the foremost person in this, you know, in this space. It was really a pretty unique opportunity. And of course, you know, when you hear about the opportunities that photoacoustic imaging can potentially give you, the first question that came up was, well, how come we haven't done it yet? You know, and of course, you know, there's been lots of demonstrations outside of the brain, and, you know, the skull, as you know, is really really what makes the brain mysterious, right? You know, there's really even x-rays. I mean, there's x-rays, the earliest kind of medical imaging. I mean, we have chest x-rays and abdominal x-rays and x-rays of arms and legs and things like that. But we don't have any brain x-rays because, you know, the radiation to penetrate the skull will essentially wipe out all of the details associated with the brain, you know? And so the skull has always been the challenge. And so, you know, John and I met, you know, work at Rancho Los Amigos National Rehabilitation Center, where we take care of a lot of people, and we do a lot of skull reconstructions on people who've had hemicranies, where you know, the part of the skull is removed. And so we thought that, and these patients really suffer from a variety of functional deficits as a result of the brain trauma, right? And so we thought that this would be a great opportunity for us to develop a tool with the patients that could potentially need the treatments for it later on, right? And yeah, so that's how this team came together.
All right. So then when we think about fMRI and fPACT, what are the, I guess, the most significant differences between them, and what makes fPACT, you know, that perhaps more beneficial alternative?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. It's just such a different platform. So, you know, you're using light, and different wavelengths of light can be absorbed by different things within the body. We used, you know, a wavelength that hemoglobin absorbs so that we could see the blood flow very well and we can quantify it. So we were able to look at the structure of the blood vessels and then look at the changes in blood flow with function. The structure we could match up to the blood vessels in an MRI, and that's how we could compare the two. But the platform is just so different. There's no magnetic field. You're not within a confined tube. The wavelengths of light can be altered to be absorbed by different things within the brain in order to image, you know, a wide variety potential molecules. We chose obviously hemoglobin, but you know it's sort of limitless, almost what you could design. And then the speed of it and the scalability of it is also something that I think sets it apart from MRI. It's just a totally different imaging platform with different opportunities. I think I started out saying, I think they really are going to be complementary, not competitive.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
And Dr. Liu, you mentioned the complicating factor of the skull. So I'll direct this question to you. You know, what challenges are there to developing, you know, fPACT and then putting, you know, this type of technology into use with humans?
Yeah. So, you know, our it really becomes issue related to signal and noise and distortion. You know, the signal we're trying to measure and quantify is a very small signal. It's buried inside a lot of noise. And so it seemed to us that the most expeditious way forward And, you know, there had been other demonstrations of using photoacoustic imaging in, for example, mouse brain, right, where the skull is wafer thin, right? It's very, very thin. And so we know that in principle it can be done to look at brain. You know, of course, people don't tend to get excited until it gets into, I mean, certainly we don't get excited as clinicians, right, until it gets into humans. And so the human skull happens to be very thick. And, you know, Li Hong describes the skull as a lens, and it's a really bad one, you know, and that, you know, it's sort of like looking through a really distorted glass, you know, everything becomes really wavy. And also it generates a suboptimal signal noise ratio. So we thought that perhaps the best way forward was to work with patients that, you know, have no skulls, right? And these are patients that have the hemicranies. And, you know, once you know what you're looking at, then you can improve the technique in an iterative way, where you can start imagining skull implants, for example, right? That not as bad as skull, but not as good as nothing at all, right? As an intermediate step to eventually, you know, get to where we can do this in intact humans. I think that, you know, ultimately would be the goal, of course, right? Because it just can't be, oh yeah, you know, you can get a scan, but we have to remove your skull first. I mean, that's really not practical.
Well, you know, you were saying earlier that in order to know if something new works, you have to test it against the gold standard. So how was this tested? And, you know, what results did you see? And you know, were there any surprises based on the investigation?
I would say, I think all of us were surprised sort of how good the images were that we got from this sort of first iteration. And it had a lot to do with obviously us not having to deal with the skull in these particular patients. But the, you know, the functional imaging that we got was comparable to a 7T MRI. So this is a machine built obviously by one of the world's experts in photoacoustics in Dr. Li Hong Wang and his team. But it still is the, you know, Model T version. I mean, it is, you know, in the, you know, basement of his lab, and was assembled by his you know, team of researchers. This is not a commercial, you know, instrument that has been, you know, matured over decades. And I think it really sort of stood out to us that immediately we were able to get functional images that are comparable to 7T MRI, which is the best sort of clinical MRI we have. And, you know, I think, you know, what that does for us in our mind, right, obviously we're biased, right, but when we put it in for publication, you know, a high level publication, you know, critiqued this and agreed that this was, you know, a good sort of match between FPACT and MRI. And so in order to actually push it forward, to get commercial interests interested in it, to see people want to put money into it, invest in a technology, you got to demonstrate something that's, you know, sort of impressive and important. And I think this is one of those sort of landmark demonstrations of brain imaging that'll stand for, you know, for, I mean, we'll see, right? History will tell, but I think this is a really important sort of landmark functional imaging study of the human brain.
Yeah, I just to add to that, I think that, you know, again, it's, you know, I've learned that it's not necessarily appropriate, even, you know, necessary to be hyperbolic about predicting the importance of things, you know. And John mentioned these high impact publications, and, you know, every month these publications come out, right? And yet, and I think they're all really great contributions. But the world's not changing on a monthly basis, and it's usually iterative, right? And so we think that, you know, that some of these challenges related to fMRI are in fact inherent to the technology, and you know, you just extrapolate the curve of development of MRI technology, and you see that the curve is essentially stronger and stronger and stronger magnets, right, which are heavier and heavier and heavier and more and more and more costly. And so you know, I think that, you know, of course, you never, you do hope that the technology continues to develop, because there are significant limitations to the photoacoustic technique, right? It you know, the depth of penetration and the ability to essentially scan the entirety of the head, right, is still, you know, a challenge that needs to be overcome. And yeah, I think that, you know, human beings and engineers have been pretty good at taking scientific principles and manipulating it. But the, you know, the 7 Tesla MRI, as John mentioned, is a remarkable machine. And, you know, the quality of the images are superlative. And so, you know, the pleasant surprise, I suppose, exactly as you mentioned, was that, you know, we were, you know, hoping, right, to see good images, you know, but to see that they were, in fact, comparable and in some ways, you know, some ways superior, right, at this stage was, you know, very exciting.
And you were saying, you know, that it's, you don't necessarily want to kind of predict the impact on the industry per se, but when we think about perhaps benefits for provider and for patient, what potentially could we see kind of come from greater use of this once things kind of, you know, get up and running and it's, you know, like you said, out of the basement? What are the possible impacts that we may see for you know, provider and patient alike?
Yeah, my guess is that the most significant impact it's going to make in the short term is probably in the research world. Because now you have an environment, Charles mentioned this before, where you can introduce devices that currently affect brain function, be it DBS for Parkinson's, things that you can't really study in an on-off fashion inside of an MRI machine. But photoacoustics may lend itself, because you can have people outside of a tube in a favorable environment where they can, you know, perform tasks with these devices. On and off, and you know, in different settings, different frequencies, you can, you know, really start to look at how these devices affect brain function and why we see, you know, changes in phenotype and in performance. And I think that's going to be the earliest impact. I think the clinical impact is going to be down the line, and it'll depend, I think, how quickly we're able to mature the technology to be favorable for, you know, transcranial imaging with either the skull intact or implants there, because everybody who has a craniotomy, you know, has some sort of implant put in, whether it's their own bone back or whether there's a, you know, potentially more favorable implant put back in that can, you know, help follow their disease. So that's sort of what, you know, my guess is as far as what we'll see going forward.
Yeah, I would agree with Dr. Russin. I would just add that when you think about impact, you know, you think about direct consequences and then indirect. And I think that, you know, in terms of direct consequence, I think that, you know, the ability to extract, you know, complex, very small signals, right, faint signals from a field of noise has been, it's not unique to this particular situation, right? I mean, in virtually, you know, anything humans do that involves extraction of information has this. So I'm confident that it will be solved. And, you know, when it is solved, then I think that just, you know, so we're really proud of the 7 Tesla MRI we have at USC, you know, and I've got other scientific collaborators in other institutions that when you have one, people are very happy about it and you can do a lot of things with it. And, but it's not really, you know, at this point, something that everybody has, right? And so, you know, and if you look at the cost differential, you know, I mean, you really need to build a building that can house a unit like that, whereas this can really be much more, you know, modest in terms of the build. I think eventually the potentially for scaling that, you know, is there, be, you know, in terms of cost, right. And just physical presence. I think that there's some advantages. I think the indirect effects You know, maybe more. John mentioned research, but you know, research exists not. And of course, you know, we're curious, but you know, but in the end, research is done in a directed way to solve a problem. And I think that the application of the principles of physics, you know, right now, so much of therapeutics is in the realm of chemistry, right? You know, it's drugs, it's medications, it's these type of things. And you know, we're really barely scratching the surface of this whole realm of intervention, right? That can come from modulation. And so, you know, the indirect effect of this type of imaging could really be profound. I mean, it could really be, you know, much bigger than the, oh, hey, I need a brain scan, right? It could be that it is a tool that allows us to really start to understand the effect of the modulation, you know, on the brain. And and so, you know, again, we're always hopeful. And, you know, I always remind myself, you know, having been involved in things that appear to be, you know, super potentially impactful and so on and so forth, that, you know, time will tell. But, you know, certainly sitting from this point, you know, we're very optimistic. And, you know, it's very exciting anyways. You know, how often does a new imaging technique for, you know, I mean, again, we're brain people, right? So we think that the brain is the most, I mean, it's space and then the human brain, right? So, you know, how often does that happen? You know, it doesn't happen very often. And so to have played a, you know, a role in you know, demonstrating it has been really just very exciting for us.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time today. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay, Wendy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
See you, Charles.
Thank you, Drs. Liu and Russin, for joining me. And thank you for listening to The Reading Room. And as always, visit www.diagnosticimaging.com for the latest in radiology news.